Good evening and welcome behind the news for September 22, 2005. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the world of economics and politics. And I've got two segments up tonight, two interview segments. First, about 10:15 after the hour, interview recorded last week with Ariel Levy, who is the author of a book called Female Chauvinist Pigs, her analysis and condemnation of what she calls the raunch culture, girls gone wild, the spread of the aesthetics of the red light district throughout the whole culture. Book is getting some attention, and I'm not sure she's got it all right, but very interesting and certainly worth listening to and reading. Then at the bottom of the hour, interview also recorded last week with Richard Gott, who is formerly a foreign correspondent for The Guardian of London. He is his expanded and updated edition of his book, Hugo Chavez and the Bolivarian Revolution, just out from Verso. Talked to him about where Hugo Chavez came from, what he's trying to do, and what it means for the region and the hemisphere, and the people of Venezuela, and the people of a challenge to American power that Chavez represents. And before we get to that, also a little teaser from an interview I'll be running on my contribution to the fundraiser coming up, I think October 13th. I'll be doing this. An in-depth extended interview with George Galloway, the member of parliament who was here last week debating Christopher Hitchens and raising hell as he was traveling around the country, and got him in a little quieter, more reflective mode, talking about the war in Iraq, politics in the United States, and other things. And I'll play just a little brief teaser from that later to whet your appetite, but it will be broadcast in full on October 13 on this show. First, some of the economic headlines. The weekly tally of jobless claims up very, very substantially over the last couple of weeks now. Hurricane Katrina now finally doing its did its work long ago, but it's now being starting to appear in the economic statistics. Last week's tally of claims was raised, the estimate was raised by 26,000, and it's now up to 432,000, up over 100,000 in just 2 weeks, and most of that the result of people who lost their jobs because of Hurricane Katrina. And it's going to be a little hard to read these to determine the underlying economic trends in the coming weeks, but of course the people who lost their jobs and the economy of the Gulf region pretty considerable distress, and quite possibly more to come if Hurricane Rita follows the predictions. Broader economic indicators also looking a little on the weaker side. The Economic Cycles Research Institute's weekly leading index off a bit last week, and its rate of growth slowing down. And the Conference Board's measure of leading economic indicators, which also is supposed to forecast changes in the direction of the U.S. economy anywhere from 3 months out to a year out, that now falling for two consecutive months. It's certainly not pointing to recession yet, but it does suggest some kind of slowdown maybe in our future. But really taking a dive of the measures of consumer attitudes, the ABC News, Washington Post Weekly Consumer Comfort Index, and a sharp, sharp dive off 16 points in just a little over a month, people saying the state of the national economy is eroding, reporting considerable increase in stress in their own personal finances. So a very dramatic decline in the consumer confidence numbers. Rasmussen, a polling firm that does a daily consumer index, its measure has been falling quite sharply for the last couple of weeks, and it's off about 16-17% over the last year, off about 5 or 6% just over the last week, and 29% of Americans say their own finances are getting better. 52% say their personal finances are getting worse. Quite a reversal from what we saw at the beginning of the year. Earlier this week, the Federal Reserve tightened, that raised the short-term interest rates under the direct control by a quarter of a point. Some people had been suspecting that the Fed was going to pause as a humanitarian gesture in the wake of Katrina, but also as a recognition of some of the ambiguities about the economic impact of the hurricane. But the Fed is not. I think it's now tightened 11 consecutive times at 11 consecutive meetings. And the statement they issued with the policy decision was much more worried about inflation than a lot of people were expecting. Now, I got to wonder, are they telling the full truth here? Yes, the spike in energy prices that we've seen over the last months is potentially inflationary, but wage growth, a major driver of long-term inflation trends, is quite weak, which is another way of saying that wages are lagging inflation. The average worker's standard of living is eroding slowly. It's hard to shake the suspicion that the Federal Reserve is really trying to burst the housing bubble, and that is now showing some early signs of strain. I've talked a lot here about that housing bubble. Questions over whether it is a bubble have now largely receded, now that even Alan Greenspan has admitted that the market looks frothy. Rising house prices are generally thought of as a good thing in the straight press, but why is that? As the late Ed Hart, the credit market analyst on the late Financial News Network, used to say, housing inflation is the American national religion. Housing inflation is great if you're living in a hot area, can sell your house and move somewhere cheap, but otherwise it just makes one of the essentials of life, shelter, harder to afford. Sure enough, despite all the allegedly good economic times, homeownership has fallen as a percentage of the population for the first two quarters of this year and is now back where it was at the end of 2003. So an end to the housing bubble might be good news for first-time buyers, but it could be bad news, very bad news, for people who stretched, took out too big a mortgage or one with low initial interest rates. They're going to be adjusted higher in the future. People who stretched on the assumption that prices would keep rising forever. There's a chance that breaking a housing bubble could finish the work that started when the stock market fell apart 5 years ago. The rather weak economy we've seen over the last few years has been the result, I think, of a hangover from that bubble. Employers, for example, have been reluctant to hire or to invest or take on major commitments. But still, the economic fallout from the bursting of the stock bubble has been relatively mild. Compare our experience to Japan's more than 10-year economic funk following the bursting of their bubble in the early 1990s, which is only now showing signs of coming to an end. It looks like the Japanese economy is finally recovering. But the bursting of the housing bubble in the U.S. would hit many more households in the middle and upper middle income brackets than the bursting of the stock market bubble did. So we shall see. Merrill Lynch economist David Rosenberg points out that we're witnessing a triple play. Everybody but me loves those baseball metaphors. The Fed is pushing interest rates higher, one. The oil price is surging, two. And the stock market has been sinking, three. This conjunction of events has happened just seven times over the last 50 years, and every one ushered in a significant economic slowdown, a recession or something close to it. With a lot of households in questionable financial shape, a recession could have some unpleasant effects, so we'll keep watching that. And now, let's listen to this excerpt from an interview I recorded last week with George Galloway. I'll be broadcasting it in full in 2 weeks from today. We're actually 3 weeks from today, I think. October 13th? Yeah, 3 weeks. Galloway is a member of Parliament who came here and caused a stir in the U.S. Senate earlier this year and is now touring the U.S. Promoting his book, Mr. Galloway Goes to Washington, and causing political trouble wherever he goes. Let's listen to this about 3-minute excerpt. It's the full interview is about 33 minutes, but we'll hear that in a few weeks. But let's just listen to this little taste. George Galloway.
Saddam has the view, again I'm afraid to say, it's a view that's shared by many but not by me, that America is Rome and Britain is Greece. Britain is the older, more civilized, more sophisticated power that can whisper in the ear of the new brute Roman American Empire. And the belief that somebody like Mr. Blair or someone like Britain can really guide and may even be guiding, may even be manipulating. This is the line of the likes of Lyndon LaRouche and others, that actually Britain is the mastermind, the maestro behind all of this, and the poor Americans are being worked from behind like a kind of glove puppet. It's all nonsense, of course. Britain is not Greece. America is not Rome. In any case, we have no influence over America at all. Absolutely none. I mean, look how our people were treated in New Orleans. So much for the special relationship. Yet, special relationship is the sort of Monica Lewinsky relationship, which requires the weaker partner to always be on their knees, serving the stronger partner, I'm afraid to say, if that's not too colourful a metaphor for your family show. The idea that Britain is a civilising influence on the United States is rubbish. First of all, we don't have any real influence, and secondly, if we did, it wouldn't be a civilising one.
I do want to return to the issue of what Britain gets out of this in a moment, but first of all, the attitude that Saddam displayed, the Anglophilia you described, in Iraq and also elsewhere in the Arab world, is this some sort of psychopathology, a post-colonial psychopathology, or is there something else to it? What do you make of it?
It's partly clutching at straws, but it is psychopathology. It is a colonized mind, colonized mentality. It's one of the reasons, for example, as we're having quite a serious conversation, I can go into this. It's one of the reasons why so many Muslims don't believe that Muslims were responsible for 9/11. They spin all these absurd conspiracy theories that, you know, Bush did it, the Zionists did it, they knew it was coming, they arranged it. And
that's popular with some of our loonier people on the left.
Well, it's very popular. It's widely popular in the United States, and it's completely preposterous rubbish. But it's virtually universally the view of Muslims. And one of the reasons why is that they don't believe that Muslims could have carried out such a sophisticated act as 9/11, as successfully as the dastardly murder of 3,000 people was. This is, again, a sign of almost self-hatred, a sense of inferiority, of unworthiness, and the superiority of the foreigner, the Khawaja in Arabic, is widely believed by many Arabs, and frankly many people from formerly colonized countries, yourselves being an exception, perhaps because you so long ago slipped the colonial yoke, that somehow the white man is top dog because he is top dog.
And now an excerpt from my interview with George Galloway, which will be broadcast in full on my fundraising show on October 13. About 30 more minutes of that. And George Galloway, member of the British Parliament and author of the book Mr. Galloway Goes to Washington, which is just out from the New Press. Well, let's take this little musical break to set up Ariel Levy.
You got me tingling, come to me mingling, stepping off, looking bootylicious and jingling. When you walk, I see it, baby. When you talk, I believe it, baby. I like that thick, petite, pretty, little touches to get it. Love to work to get it. She loves to stir it up. I can hear her purring up, but she's the type that will get your rowdy up. Get you excited and call her boyfriend up. What's the plan without the plan B? We can meet up at the Huddle House for the TV.
And add a little bit from the song Belly Dancer, which I think was a hit in the British clubs this summer, by Akon. That is sort of a rude setup for this interview with Ariel Levy, who is the author of the book Female Chauvinist Pigs, which is just out from the Free Press. And we can let her define what she means by the raunch culture, which she is none too pleased with. Ariel Levy.
Just what is this raunch culture, and how did you get interested in it?
Well, raunch culture is this spread of the aesthetics and values of the red light district into mainstream culture. So it's, you know, Jenna Jameson being on the bestseller list, and it's cardio striptease classes at gyms, and it's little girls walking around with a Playboy bunny on their T-shirt. And I got interested in it because, the main reason was that I had a good friend who a couple years ago, she was just really into all this. I mean, she was always sort of telling me about, you know, seeing a porn star on the Howard Stern show, or, you know, she would go to strip clubs. I mean, this is a really smart person and someone I went to college with who, you know, went to take back the night marches on campus and cared about feminism. And so it just interested me. If somebody who I considered really intelligent and enlightened and terrific was so into this, you know, I was interested in who else was into it. And you know, it's a huge trend. It's very pervasive, not just among men, but what I'm interested in is how pervasive this trend is among women.
Who is the perceived audience for it? Is it to please men or what?
Well, so the title of my book is Female Chauvinist Pigs, and the idea is that, you know, if male chauvinist pigs of years past were guys who made women into pieces of meat, female chauvinist pigs are women who objectify other women and themselves and think of that as empowerment. And I think that's the idea here, is it's you know, the idea is that ranch culture is actually good for us. And even though these are the very, you know, things that feminism reviled, women now are sort of imagining that this is going to make them sexually liberated and empowered and strong.
This may sound like grammatical nitpicking, but a male chauvinist pig is a chauvinist for male interests and presumably wants to subordinate women to his pleasure and advantage. A female chauvinist pig is certainly not turning the tables.
On the contrary.
Magnifying female power. So who is the beneficiary of this, or the perceived beneficiary?
Actually, I mean, the sort of slippery play on words I'm trying to do is, you know, female chauvinist pigs actually, they believe still that men are superior. That's what I'm arguing in this book, is that, you know, that a lot of women I spoke to, you know, on the one hand they would sort of be emulating strippers and porn stars in terms of their self-presentation and in terms of the way they thought about their own sexuality. But on the other hand, they always said they wanted to be like a man, and that they thought, you know, they didn't want to be prissy, right? So they wanted to be like guys who sort of enjoyed ranch culture. They wanted to join the frat party that, you know, they perceived as going on around them in pop culture. And they sort of think of men as having all the answers to, you know, living a life that's exciting and libidinous and filled with adventure. And they sort of, so they think those qualities, you know, male, and then the female qualities they want to embody are sort of cartoon-like, you know, having huge fake breasts and bleached blonde hair, that kind of thing.
You spent some time following the Girls Gone Wild crew around. I've always been amazed watching those commercials on TV. Who does these? Who flashes her boobs and why?
Well, it's so interesting. You know, a couple of people I've talked to said, you know, those are staged, right? And the answer is no. It really happens. Like, these guys walk around in these Girls Gone Wild t-shirts with their cameras and just walk down the street. And it's as if, you know, by ensorcelment, women flock to them and literally just start flashing their breasts and making out. And, you know, they're not paid. I mean, they do this for free. And so there's this one teenage girl who did this, and I said, you know, why'd you do this, and what do you get out of this? And she looked at me like I was nuts, and she said, you know, the only way I could see somebody not doing this is if she were considering a career in politics. I mean, I thought that was very telling. I mean, it's this idea that, of course, we should be doing this. Like, part of the job description of being female now is that you should be, you know, exploding in little blasts of exhibitionism all the time.
In some cases, porn stars and strippers are pretty well paid. You know, we hear stories of women paying their way through graduate school stripping. What's the difference between doing it for pay and doing it for free?
Well, two things. First of all, I would say, you know, they're the exceptions. I mean, the porn stars that we hear about, like Jenna Jameson, the strippers we see on TV in the reality shows, they're the exception. The vast majority of women who get into the sex industry do so because they're poor, and the vast majority stay poor. So, I mean, I think we get the sort of sunniest case scenario when we see this stuff. But the thing is, you know, so that's their job. I mean, you understand why they're doing it. It's straightforward. They're getting paid. Their job is to fake lust. So then when women who aren't getting paid imitate them and imagine that's going to make them sexually empowered, it's a sad state of affairs. I mean, you don't want to be copying somebody whose job it is to copy real lust in order to experience sexual pleasure. It's not going to work.
You have a very interesting chapter on how this culture has somewhat infiltrated the lesbian world,
mm-hmm.
And how the desire to be like a man, which I suppose means emotionally distant and uninvolved, and just a sex machine,
uh-huh.
With no connection to heart or head. Why is that happening, do you think?
Well, you know, I mean, see, the reason that chapter is in here is essentially, you know, the group I spoke about in there is sort of, you know, a pretty marginal group even within the lesbian community. And the point is sort of, you know, if we just look at this trend in terms of the way it's impacting, you know, entertainment or something, you can sort of write it off as, oh, well, this is just what's happening in Hollywood. But I was trying to trace this all around the country. And the fact is, you know, if a trend is even influencing, like, the fringe, then you know it's pretty widespread, was the idea with that.
But there's this notion of what boys are like or thought they're like, that certainly I don't find very appealing.
Right.
But some of the men that actually appear in your book are kind of sympathetic, like that that kid who didn't want to rape his girlfriend, as he put it. He felt like he'd be raping her if he had sex with her after she said she wasn't really interested. I mean, it doesn't come off like the traditional male chauvinist pig of old. What does this say about the state of gender relations here?
You know, I mean, the thing I was trying to do, you know, I'm sure that if somebody else sort of did a book about how raunch culture affects men, you know, they'd sort of find a real array, you know, a real spectrum. This book was really, I set out to think about women. So, you know, there aren't that many guys in here. I mean, it's really about saying to women, you know, we've sort of taken for granted that, you know, if we follow the culture and if we just are as exhibitionistic as possible, then everything is going to work out right. And this is a book questioning that. And you know, I mean, and it is true. One voice that articulates that nicely is a different teenage boy who says, you know, I don't understand why girls are working so hard. Guys always like girls. And I thought that was a pretty good point because, you know, his classmates, I mean, the teen girls he was friends with who I interviewed, one of them said to me, you know, to see who can dress the sluttiest, you know, to see who can be the skankiest, that's the one way we all compete. Which I just thought was interesting. I mean, is that the way we want our teenage girls, you know, spending their time to compete to see who can be the biggest skank? I mean, that can't be liberation. That can't be the best case scenario for us.
Well, what struck me on reading it is that it seems in a lot of ways like the flip side of American Puritanism, that we've Puritanism and Purians are two sides of the same coin, and what we really fail to do is have any kind of integration of sexual pleasure and the rest of our lives. Is that...
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, I think that it's totally that. I mean, you know, there's like this real extreme way of thinking of things where let's keep everybody covered up and let's be Puritans. And then this is sort of like at the other pole, you know, just sort of making sexuality as sort of bald and bold as possible. And the thing about it is I don't actually think we're a hyper-sexualized culture, which is what everybody always says. I mean, I think we're hyper-commercial. I mean, I think this is sort of the easiest shorthand for sex we can find. And it's very easy to sell, and it's very easy to represent by just, you know, showing women with fake boobs and small articles of clothing. But it's not really about any kind of profound exploration of sexuality and what that can sort of offer us as humans.
I was interested, you said some research showing that most American teenagers are likely to have sex just for sex, whereas in Western Europe it's often in the context of a relationship. What do you make of that?
I think it's from the Alan Guttmacher Institute that I got that stat, and the thing that they say is, you know, that's probably as a result of, you know, negative attitudes about teen sex. I mean, it is really an interesting thing, and I really think I sympathize with people who have teens. I think it's really challenging because on the one hand, of course, you do want to encourage them to wait until they're mature enough to deal with sex, and, you know, at the same time, you want to be realistic and you want these kids to be well-informed, and most are not. I mean, 80% of the schools in this country that have sex ed teach abstinence only and either don't teach about contraception or misinform kids and teach them that contraception doesn't work, which is too bad. And I think that, you know, if what we're saying to kids is just say no to sex, I think it makes some sense that, you know, if they're going to sort of flip, which is the way we've constructed it, and engage in sex, it's going to be in some sort of furtive manner as opposed to in the context of a relationship where, you know, we've encouraged them, we've taught them, instead of just saying just say no, we've taught them, here's when you can say yes, here's when it's a good idea to say yes, if you love someone, if you feel safe, if there's some kind of commitment, if you think it's going to deepen your relationship and, you know, make you happy, you know, whatever it is you want to teach your kid about it that's more sophisticated than just say no.
Speaking with Ariel Levy, who is the author of Female Chauvinist Pigs, just out from the Free Press, let's look at the role of feminism in this. I think a lot of the women who embrace the raunch culture would not call themselves feminists and even think that feminism is a kind of stodgy thing. I mean, on the one hand, we do have a considerable degree of advance of the role of women in the workplace and elsewhere. On the other hand, we have this broad unpopularity of feminism. It's seen as a holdover of the hairy legged days of the 70s. So,
uh-huh.
What is the relation of raunch culture to the success of
earlier feminism? You know, it's interesting. I mean, it's two things. things at once. I mean, I think some of the women engaging in this are absolutely sort of rebelling against their mothers and saying, you know, I don't want to be a feminist, and rebelling against this period in the 80s when we really were pretty rigid about gender politics, and, you know, everything was PC, and it was sort of strict in a way, and that started to seem silly to people. So they're rebelling against that. On the other hand, plenty of these women think that they're actually continuing the work of the women's movement, and think that, you know, liberation and, like, that bodiness is liberation, that exhibitionism is empowerment, and, you know, they think that they are enacting feminism and making themselves more powerful. And I question that. I mean, this is a book sort of questioning that assumption and talking about the limits of raunch culture, you know, for bringing anybody any closer to power.
How does this phenomenon compare to, say, the work of someone like Susie Bright, who's, you know, trying to make female desire and female pleasure prominent and important? And in some ways, this almost seems like a parody of it. But what do you think of the relation of that to...
Well, I think anybody, you know, like Susie Bright, but anyone who's really focused on female pleasure and, you know, women getting what they want from sex, I think that's fantastic, you know. And I think Susie Bright goes about that with a lot of creativity, and she's just a lot of fun. But, I mean, I think that, you know, embracing Playboy, for example, is like a totally different thing. I mean, I don't think Playboy is invested in female pleasure. I think it's invested in female performance, and that's different. You know, trying to act like a stripper is not, maybe for, you know, for some women, for a few women, that is what they actually want. But at this point, this trend is so pervasive, it's not really, it doesn't feel like an option. It feels like an obligation. And I don't think all the people who are engaging in this are doing so because it's actually the most authentic expression of their sexual desire.
You mentioned Playboy, and you've got some amazing quotes from Hugh Hefner in the book. Tell us about Hefner's history.
So much fun to think about. Well, so, you know, Hefner's just an interesting example because, I mean, you know, he's supposed to be the king of the sexual revolution, right? But his sexual revolution is for men only. And you know, it was back then, and it is now. I mean, if he has this reality show now, The Girls Next Door, and it's him and these girls at the mansion, you know, living their lives. And he's got this stable of women. They all have a curfew. You know, they all have a 9 p.m. curfew. They're all supposed to be monogamous. I mean, you know, faithful to him. I mean, it's not about equality. How anybody can think that Playboy is good for women is just beyond me.
But his company is run by a woman who is regarded by a lot of turnaround experts as something of a master of the field. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, she's a fairly shrewd businesswoman. I think it was smart of her to realize that she had to start marketing her merchandise to women if she was going to keep up, especially now that the magazine isn't doing so well. But that's, just because a business is going well doesn't mean that it's liberating for women. I mean, those are two separate things, unfortunately.
Well, I'm still not clear about is why this happened at this particular historical moment. Why now? Why is this kind of parody, the Playboy girl, being embraced by women at a moment when large numbers of men don't necessarily seem to be demanding it?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, men don't need to demand anymore. I think women have sort of internalized this obligation at this point. And I also think that, you know, because women have made so many advances, because women are catching up in the workplace, you know, there's this sense of wanting to sort of apologize for how far we've come and to sort of reassure the people around us and say, you know, don't worry, I'm still, you know, I'm still a porn star within. I mean, I'm still just a sex symbol. You don't need to feel threatened by me. I think there's some of that.
And then I guess these sorts of things always end at the what is to be done question. Is this, do you intend this as some kind of manifesto to action or just a piece of analysis?
Well, I mean, the first action is just thinking about this. I mean, I think it's been incredibly unfashionable to have this discussion. I mean, there's been very little sort of discussion of what we're doing and this sort of, you know, unquestioned moving along with, oh, yeah, you know, I will go to a cardio striptease class, I'll wear the Playboy bunny, that's what's going to happen. And so the first thing is just to think about it and to educate our daughters differently. I mean, I think that's really important. I think, you know, if women who are in their 20s or 30s or older are sort of rebelling against feminism, teen girls aren't. They have no feminism to rebel against. They never existed in a time when feminism, you know, had an active presence in culture. So I think, you know, I think we should think about what we're doing, and I think we should really pay attention to what our daughters are doing.
And that was Ariel Levy, who is the author of the book Female Chauvinist Pigs, just out from the Free Press. I have never been to a cardio strip class, and I probably never will go to one either. Let's take a little break, and then we'll be back in just a little bit with Richard Cott.
You're tuned to Hi-Fi, WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial, New York.
Moorish, Orthodox, Radio, Crusade, Anarchism for the global city, Radical environmentalism for the concrete jungle, esoteric explorations of the secret history of rebel culture. Every Tuesday at midnight, after the news, on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI, 99.5 FM.
And this is Doug Hinwood. The program is Behind the News. And let's take this little musical break before we listen to Richard Gott.
Once there was a land that was grand as grand can be. Won't you send in a light? Send in a light. But it was drowning in fears, in its doubt and misery. Won't you send in a man with a light? Tell me what was his name? Tell me what was his name? Who is the man that we honor and acclaim? What was his name? Tell me what was his name? Ronald Reagan of honor and fame. Darkness had come, seemed the enemy had won. Send in light, send in light. A war in Vietnam, all but crushed this mighty land. Won't you send in a man with a light? What was his name? Tell me what was his name? Who is the man that led us back again? What was his name? Tell me what was his name? Ronald Reagan of honor and fame. Who was the man who freed the hostage?
And that's an excerpt from the song, the Ronald Reagan song by Edward C. Hayes, whoever that is, which you can download from the 365 Days Project, which is FUBU.com or PennSound at writing.upenn.edu/PennSound, P-E-N-N-S-O-U-N-D. There are many, many cheesy musical curiosities at that 365 Days Project, and that was one of them. But now let's listen to something about a real political leader, not a cardboard one like Ronald Reagan. This is Hugo, I'm speaking of Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, and Richard Gott, who has been following Latin American politics for many years, formerly a writer with The Guardian newspaper. And now Verso has issued an updated and expanded edition of his book, Hugo Chavez and the Bolivarian Revolution, just out in paperback. And I recorded this interview with him last week. So let's listen to Richard Gott talking about Hugo Chavez.
Where did Hugo Chavez come from? He's not a man who emerged. He may have emerged onto the world scene with something of a thunderclap, but he actually has quite a long history. So, could you review that for us?
Yes, he does. He comes from the provinces of Venezuela. He studied in the town of Barinas. His parents were both school teachers, and he joined the army. And I think he was rather a good sort of teacher from the word go. He made his way up the ranks, ended up as a colonel, and he was a very popular lecturer in the War College. And he formed a sort of revolutionary group with some friends in the army in the 1980s, and staged a coup d'état in 1992, which was unsuccessful, but it woke up the country to his existence. And for various reasons, Venezuela had been rather unsatisfactorily governed for rather a long time, and people were looking for some sort of change in the system. And he was released from prison after the coup, after about a couple of years, and then after 3 or 4 years of sort of organizing, he stood as president and rather miraculously was elected president. And
I was astonished that for a man who mounted a coup against the government, he was punished rather lightly, and he was out of jail pretty quickly. And even while in jail, he had a fairly high public profile. Why is that?
Well, that sort of thing that happens quite often in Latin America, that somehow or other sort of the army is, people in the army are often regarded as sort of part of the political system. And for various reasons, his coup was actually perceived as being rather a popular coup. And so he was let out of prison rather early on because that was thought by the then president that that would be a popular thing to do. So he did sort of catch the popular mood of the country at a very early stage before he was elected president.
There's a phrase in the book that really leapt out at me. You describe a revolutionary lieutenant of Trotsky's leanings who was educated at Harvard. This is not what we usually think of the Latin American military like. So there is a long-standing left-wing tradition in Latin American militaries from which Chavez emerges, right?
That's absolutely true. And for example, and particularly noticeable in Venezuela, I think two things come to mind. One is that the Venezuelan Communist Party, which is quite a powerful communist party traditionally, rather like the Italian one, and of course lots of Venezuelans come from Italy, they had a long tradition of working with the military and sort of staging coups. So there was this rather strange tradition in the country. And secondly, the Venezuelan military also were sort of introduced to civilian society by clever colonels going off to study at the university in civil society. So they, in a curious way, they were part of the civilian society rather than being sort of locked up in their military caste, which would happen in countries like Argentina or Chile, where the military are much more remote from the people.
And, of course, Chavez has been elected not merely once, but several times. I think a lot of people, a lot of Western or Northern leftists, always are a little nervous about him, see him as perhaps some sort of yet another dictator and fatigued. But he's really gone to quite some lengths to dispel that impression, hasn't he?
He has, yes. I mean, I think that it is, after what happened in Chile and Argentina and countries of the South in the 1960s, 70s and 80s, there was this terrible sort of tradition of generals emerging in dark glasses. And so I think sort of particularly on the left, there is a certain distrust for military figures. But actually in Latin America, quite apart from what we've said about Venezuela, there have been several occasions in the past century where progressive figures have emerged from the military and have been very reformist. There was a wonderful man in Peru called Velasco Alvarado, and he, you know, passed a very radical land reform and brought the Indians into national life. And so there are various people of this sort in the past that have taken up left-wing programs.
But, of course, let's review some of the electoral history of Chavez. He was elected first in 1999, but there's a constitutional assembly, referendum, recalls. Could you review some of that history for us?
Yes. I mean, the first thing he did after, the very first thing he did after being elected in actually the end of 1998, he was to have a referendum for a new constitution. And then they had a constitutional assembly, and then they wrote a new constitution, and then there were another elections to ratify the new constitution. That was actually quite a clever move because it enabled him to sort of lay out a new sort of reformist program for the country. And it had actually been a sort of demand not just of the left but also of the center in Venezuela, who felt that the ancient constitution needed to be updated. And so that was actually sort of worked quite well. And then there were various sort of local elections until then there was the great recall referendum last year, which the opposition called in order, they thought, to destroy Chavez and bring him down. But actually he'd by that time organized the country to such an extent that he was able to win rather handily. And since then his sort of opinion poll ratings have been touching 70%, which is improbable in Latin America and indeed in almost any country in the world. So he really does have the people behind him.
Tariq Ali told me the last year when I interviewed him that that Chavez consults almost daily with Fidel Castro, and Castro advised him to take this democratic route and avoid taunting the United States too much. What's that all about? What's the relation with Castro like?
Well, I think he does have a very, very, it's like a sort of father-son relationship, although it's now graduated to really they are sort of equals, because I think Chavez now has a sort of huge amount of political confidence. But it is true, he has always been extremely close to Fidel, and they meet very regularly, and now, of course, they've got this this extraordinary sort of political and really military alliance. Castro said that, you know, if Cuba was invaded, Venezuela would come to the assistance of Cuba. And they have this wonderful exchange arrangement whereby there are now something like 20,000 Cuban doctors, dentists, opticians working in the shantytowns of Venezuela. And Venezuela is providing Cuba with cheap oil. So one has to say that he is providing not just Cuba with oil, but also the countries of the Caribbean and Central America, which is something that Venezuela had actually been doing before Chavez came to be president. So all he's done is extended an existing arrangement to the island of Cuba.
I was speaking with Richard Gott, who is author of Hugo Chavez and the Bolivarian Revolution, just out in paperback for so. Let's turn to the politics of Venezuela for a while. Many Latin American countries have parasitical elites and impoverished masses. That's also true of many oil-exporting countries. Venezuela is both. Tell us about the social structure of Venezuela that Chavez is really trying to transform.
Well, it is extraordinary. It's a sort of white settler country, Venezuela. It's a country where there is a very rich white elite, many of whom have emigrated to Venezuela in the last half century, because Venezuela became an oil exporting country and it became extremely rich. It attracted people from all over Latin America, but also from Europe. And something like 1 million Italians arrived in Venezuela after 1945. So you can imagine it's a country which has a lot of recent immigrants who have done well. Many of them have worked in the oil industry. And in some ways, they're much less rooted to the country than the other elites in Latin America. In a way, they're not dissimilar from the old elite in Cuba, who really are more at home in Florida than they are in Cuba. And that's also true of the Venezuelan elite, who tended to be very urban and very reluctant to engage with the rest of the country, and never quite understood the nature of the history and geography of Venezuela itself. So there's this tiny little sort of group at the top who ran the country for many years. And then there is the great mass of the people who are, by origin, Indian and black, and mestizo, but very definitely, as it were, not white. And they are the poor, the 60, 70, 80% of the country, who never benefited from the oil wealth. And that has been, in a way, the huge sort of structural strength of Chavez, that he does have this this huge vote behind him of people who are poor. And that is what he's been able to tap into so successfully.
I was surprised to read that he taps into some of the millenarian Protestant discourse that has become popular in Latin America over the last couple of decades. Could you talk about that and the New Agey side of the Fifth Republic?
Yes, that is quite an intriguing, I think, as you've rightly said, there has been this sort of strange development in Latin America, not just in Venezuela, but everywhere, the growth of Protestant evangelicalism. And some people have thought that this was a sort of form of American imperialism, but I think though that's sort of true in parts of Central America, this is not true of the rest of the continent. It's sort of these evangelical ideas sort of spring up from the grassroots, and you can go, you know, to almost any shantytown anywhere in Latin America, and you will find these new evangelical churches, lots of different ones. And in a curious way, I think that Chavez has been able to use that sort of language, and it's very, very appealing. I think he must have come across it sort of slightly by accident.
He didn't grow up in that kind of environment?
He didn't, no. No, his parents were Christian Democrats. He was brought up as an Orthodox Roman Catholic. But now he's realized the sort of political importance of this, and he's quite often sort of emphasizes that, you know, he's a Christian, but he doesn't emphasize that he's a Catholic. So he does appeal to this religion of the poor, as it were, rather satisfactorily. And although in many countries the evangelicals in Latin America are essentially conservative or non-political, in Venezuela they have been come out in support of Chavez.
And let's talk a bit about his program, what he's trying to do in Venezuela. It's not, in many ways, it's not a radical program. There's no real serious challenge to property relations. The state is not nationalizing private industry. There's even some openness to foreign investment. So what is the political economy of the Chavez program?
That's right. He's not at all a sort of orthodox leftist. And I mean, he's been in power for sort of 6 or 7 years, and he's only this past year started using the word socialism. And even there, he sort of says we need to have a new sort of socialism, and he hasn't defined at all what it should be. And I suppose one of the sort of attractive aspects of his politics is that he's very sort of open-ended about what's going to happen. And it's sort of part of his... of these tremendous education programs he's been having, which is essentially to try and sort of educate the sort of age group between sort of 16 and 25 and get these sort of university age students into study and into work, is to bring people into the sort of body politic so that in the next, 5 to 10 years, they will be able to, make decisions about the direction in which the country should go. So he hasn't been remotely like a sort of orthodox nationalizer, putting things into the hands of the state. But on the other hand, Venezuela is a very sort of strange and peculiar country because of its being an oil-producing country, and that is where the bulk of the economic activity takes place. And there he has reinforced the state control of the oil company, which... curiously enough, I mean, it's been nationalized about 30 years ago. It's been theoretically under state control for 30 years. But in a curious way, the nationalization that took place, and I think it's sort of something similar happened in other countries, but it hasn't been very much written about. But essentially, the state oil company continued to be run as though it was a private company. The Venezuelan oil company, you know, invested abroad instead of investing in Venezuela. And, one sort of rather vivid example is that the old foreign companies, sort of Shell and Exxon and Texaco, and the ones that had invested in Venezuela for decades beforehand, they spent their entire time trying to ensure that they paid very few taxes in Venezuela. And in a curious way, the state company continued that tradition of not paying taxes. And again, you know, that was sort of absurd. How could a state company not want to pay taxes to the government? So this is one of the reforms that Chavez has been able to put through, is to make sure that the money accruing to the state company is now made available for social projects in Venezuela, which certainly didn't happen before.
Yeah, I believe all the revenue above a certain price per barrel, it was initially 14 and then marked down to 9, it was diverted into social development funds.
That's right. So that's been given him a sort of huge financial base from which to undertake these various programs.
And then also, Venezuela is a country that has relatively low foreign debt and large oil revenues. So this gives us the country a lot more freedom to maneuver politically than a heavily indebted country that didn't have oil to export, right?
Yes, I mean it's sort of. It doesn't need to go to the IMF, to the World Bank. It has its own financial revenue, and that has given it, I think, this extraordinary independence that Chavez has had to say what he thinks and do what he wants. It's been an absolutely unusual experience in Latin America, where in the past any leftist regime has always found itself almost immediately sort of in hock to the banks or, you know, in difficulties abroad because it simply hasn't been able to pay its bills, whereas Chavez has had no problem of that sort of any kind.
What exactly do they do with the Oil Development Fund?
Well, most of the money is going at the moment into these programs, which are sort of health and education. And one of the intriguing things is that these are very ad hoc arrangements. They're called missions, and there's about five or six of them. They're various sort of literacy programs, university students, higher education of one sort and another, and then these various health programs. But because the Venezuelan middle class is still, which has been in the opposition and is still very powerful in the bureaucracy, in the civil service, in the various ministries, all these new projects, these missions, have been set up outside the existing ministries and are there sort of as a sort of almost as a sort of dual state. And so they're set up without the state bureaucracy. So, of course, for example, in the health case, people are in the old health structure upset because their hospitals are not being reformed or adequately financed, and the money is all going into the shanty towns, getting help to the people who never received anything from the state before. So there's a lot of sort of conflict and contradiction, which is one of the things that makes it such an interesting country.
And I guess we'd say a lot of Chavez's radicalism, his domestic economic program might not be radical by the standards of the 60s and 70s, but internationally he is trying to develop ties across the region and challenge the dominance of Washington. Could you talk about his foreign policy a bit?
Yes. I mean, he does have this almost messianic belief in reviving the mission of Simon Bolivar to unify the countries of Latin America. And, of course, this is a very familiar Latin American theme. It's just that it seems to have sort of ground into the sand over the past sort of 30 years. But successive generations have often paid lip service to it. So it's quite easy for Chavez to go around the countries of Latin America saying, let's unite, and putting his sort of financial weight behind it. And now receiving a tremendous reception, both from governments and from the people. I mean, I think he must be the most popular sort of figure in Latin America after Fidel, who still, it's always strange to remind Americans of this, but, you know, Fidel is still a very popular figure in Latin America. And Chavez is there too. I think to begin with, many of the governments of Latin America were a bit nervous about Chavez. They didn't know what he was. They didn't know what he was on about. It was, you know, he seemed a very strange figure. And of course, he's, had a very bad press in the international press. So people had a rather distorted view of what he was doing. But actually, as the years have got by and as he's sort of strengthened in power, he has been able to go around Latin America and is now regarded as the principal statesman of the continent, and replacing people like Lula of Brazil, who could have played the role, but because of difficulties at home and also because he didn't choose to take this sort of radical line that Chavez did, has fallen back. So Chavez is sort of the leader of a new wave in Latin America. And I think what's particularly significant is that he has attacked the American-inspired policy of neoliberalism, of the Washington consensus, of all the things that have caused huge difficulties in Latin America over the last 20 years, which have essentially were designed to increase economic growth, but simply resulted in the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. And in Latin America, if the poor get poorer, they really feel the pinch. So I think that Chavez is offering a very real and attractive alternative, which is increasingly being listened to.
Yeah, and finally, Chavez is really the most dynamic figure on the South American continent, but the whole region is seeing something of an uprising against neoliberalism. We've seen Ecuador, Argentina, Brazil, although that's been a bit of a disappointment, continued rebellions in Bolivia. What do you make of this phenomenon? Is this something that has some real legs, or is this just a flash in the pan?
No, I think it is a very powerful movement. I mean, Chavez is sort of way ahead, and he's sort of, as I say, got this tremendous financial muscle. But what we're seeing is is not just a rebellion against neoliberalism, but I think it's also a rebellion that is built on indigenous movements, particularly in the countries of the Andes. You know, people are getting together, indigenous peoples, and demanding something, and that's something that just simply hasn't happened in Latin America since the 18th century. So it is something new and different, and I think they're not going to be sort of easily fobbed off. And in a curious way, the United States has really got no policy towards Latin America. It's deeply involved. It's not deeply involved now at home, but it's also deeply involved in other parts of the world, and simply doesn't have the time and the attention to direct to doing anything about Latin America. So I think myself that we're going to see a lot of exciting new developments in the next sort of 5 or 6 years all over the continent.
And that was Richard Gott, who is the author of the book Hugo Chavez and the Bolivarian Revolution, just out in an expanded, updated paperback edition from Verso. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news, and let's go out with this excerpt from a song. I bought this single in a record store in London in 1981, and I've been listening to it on and off ever since. Pig Bag. Papa's got a brand new pig bag.